Hello and welcome to the Yonder podcast. My name is Louise Doncor and I'm a Marketing Communications Manager at Yonder. Today we have a very exciting guest, someone who has definitely faced constraints in his life but has overcome them with determination and an introspectiveness that is truly inspiring. Mark Pollock is an explorer, motivational speaker and co-founder of the global running series Run in the Dark. I was very lucky to have a conversation with him. So, without further ado, here's the episode.
Tomorrow, without constraints, ideas, people, technology, and limitless thinking, defining tomorrow without constraints.
Podcast. Mark Pollock, hello and welcome to the Yonder podcast. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time. Do you want to introduce yourself? Tell everyone about yourself.
Well, I don't want to, but based on the fact you've asked me the question, I suppose I have to. Everything I do is about helping people to build resilience and collaborate with others so that together we achieve more than we thought possible. And I do that through my speaking and training business, through a global run series that we have called Run in the Dark, and also in our efforts to cure paralysis in our lifetime through the Trust and our charity partner, Collaborative Cures.
Tell me a bit more about Run in the Dark. I know you just had it. How did that go?
It was the 10th edition this year, and we had been building for the last number of years, really since my accident, when it started as a small fundraiser so that I could navigate my way out of hospital with my consequences and the impact of my spinal cord injury and get an adapted van and adapt my house in some ways, putting a lift in and so on. And I kind of evolved over the subsequent 10 years. So we grew to 25,000 people spread across 50 cities right around the world. And then this year, when the pandemic hit, catching our heads thinking, well, look, are we going to be able to do this at all? And if we do it, how can we charge the same amount of money and offer something that is attractive enough for people to buy into it all around the world? So we went virtual. We created an app, a Run in the Dark app that people could time themselves. They went on a global leaderboard, and our costs were down, our numbers were slightly down, but our profit was about the same. So I think that was a good result in the context of this year.
Yeah, I mean, I guess COVID has hit every part of people's lives, and yeah, props to you and your team for managing to still put on Run in the Dark despite the pandemic.
Well, I think there's clearly some sectors of the economy are being absolutely wiped out, and there's the obvious impact to health and all that goes with that. But I think speaking about business and perhaps even some personal lives, I think it's when a crisis strikes, it tends to force you to stop doing the things that maybe you shouldn't have been doing and rethink your approach. So there's some things that we're going to definitely keep as part of Run in the Dark. Part of my speaking business is it's forced us to be a little bit more creative and just examine why we're doing what we're doing and what we might want to do in the next 10 years.
Exactly. Yeah, it really has kind of forced us to reevaluate our lives and make changes for sure. And what about you know, yourself, just in your day to day? How did COVID impact you?
Well, very early on, I had been travelling. I was in London and Oxford, and then delivering some speaking engagements. Then I was coming back to flying back very early from London to speak in Dublin. And we went into lockdown, and it kind of wiped out in-person conference speaking businesses, which is largely where I generate fees.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realise how catastrophic it was at the time. All my bookings disappeared. And in fact, what it created was, out of necessity, it created space and the motivation and drive to creatively look at the decision themes that I'd been speaking about for nearly 20 years and to take all the reading and research that had fed into that and distill it into new products, masterclasses that we now deliver online. So it was an incredibly creative and entrepreneurial time. And without all of the travel, I was able to really schedule my days. In fact, what I found was I could do a couple of hours really good work before I got up on the computer. Then I'd go and train. Then I'd have another bit of creative thinking and product development. And then in the afternoons, they're all emails and calls and very messy. But I find it opened up a lot of space to really think and synthesize the different parts of what I'm interested in, like how we adapt, how we perform, how we collaborate, these kind of three pillars. And lots of research, lots of creation. And then I only find I understand stuff whenever I have to explain it to an audience, which we've been doing online all around the world.
Mm. And you mentioned paralysis before. You've been involved in some really remarkable work that uses technology to help with paralysis. Can you tell us more a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I always thought of my story sort of in two halves. There are sort of three chapters now. I used to be able to see and walk, and then I lost my sight. I became an adventure athlete, and 10 years after going blind, I did a 43-day expedition race to the South Pole. And for that expedition, I had to go to the gym, I had to train, I had to learn new skills, I had to put a team together, raise money, and then stick in there for the long haul to eventually arrive at the South Pole. And a year after getting back, I fell out of a second-story window and broke my back. And I found myself in hospital with no real option of being a blind and paralyzed adventure athlete. I could do long-distance expeditions, but I couldn't be in the race, particularly because I was on a different form of transport very often, hand bikes and so on. So I switched my attention to a new expedition, this time to cure paralysis in our lifetime. And it requires the same skills, turning up in the gym, walking in robotic legs, using electrical stimulation on my spinal cord, training on a regular and consistent basis, putting teams together, different scientists and technologists, raising money through philanthropy and investment, telling the story about it. And it, in many ways, it's just a different backdrop for the skills that I learned as a sportsman, putting together expedition teams and applying that to a different area. And over the last 10 years, we've created projects worth €10 million to move us forward towards the cure.
Yeah, that's amazing. I saw some of your story in the your documentary Unbreakable. What made you decide to film that?
Well, I'll tell you the truth of the matter was we had just finished a documentary which, strangely, we called Blind Man Walking, and that was a story about going blind, rebuilding my identity, some of the adventures, and eventually the story culminating with our arrival at the South Pole. So that was the story. I hoped that's where the story was going to end and life would go on happily ever after. I had the accident, and my friend Ross Whittaker, who's the filmmaker, figured, well, look, maybe we continue to film. And I was very keen at the time that we did that. And the end of the story might not have been at the South Pole. It might have been with me recovering and perhaps walking out of the hospital. So we didn't want to miss that. Now, as it turned out, it completely changed into a second film. The story of breaking my back and then going on this mission to create collaborations that had never been done before in science and technology. And I did walk in robotic legs in UCLA in Los Angeles, add electrical stimulation to the spinal cord to allow for voluntary movement. And the end of that documentary was me walking in UCLA. And I think you said that something like this isn't the end, this is only the beginning. And it came out in 2014. And really, over the last 6 years, we've continued to build relationships with scientists and technologists and funders, but we've identified that it's not just a case of getting great scientists to work together, but when those scientists have a great breakthrough, as so many of them do. How do we get them in to spin out companies? How do those companies get funded? How do they become viable businesses? Because only whenever they get to that point do they make it into the hands and lives of those people who need those interventions most. So the documentary, to answer your question, it was really just to be a different ending rather than arriving at the South Pole. It was to be recovering from paralysis. It looks like we're just going to have to extend the timelines on that a little bit more.
So now it's kind of looking at the business side of things. First of all, it's the kind of scientific side, and now it's getting into how does that science then come through into business?
Yeah, and it's sort of constantly learning, and the more I learn, the more I realise I don't know. But there's a consistent pattern that we see in science, and I think we see it in business. We see it whenever sports teams start to unravel, and that pattern is one of fragmentation. There's fragmentation right across the system. We talk about collaboration a lot in the world, but we're very poor at it. So what I'm interested in is how do we bring people together? How do we find a way to work together? And some early work that we've done with Accenture and the World Economic Forum and the Milken Institute has suggested that there's widespread absence of shared missions. There is a lack of people embodying collaborative leadership. There are disincentives to collaboration as opposed to incentives to collaborative behaviour. And whenever those three things are not in place, shared missions, embodying collaborative leadership, and incentivizing collaborative behaviour, we see a breakdown and erosion of trust and people retreating to look after their little piece of the pie. And in fact, what we want to do is create the conditions for trust by finding the shared mission, by leaders and encouraging leaders and supporting leaders to embody that collaborative leadership and finding ways to incentivize collaborative behavior, whether it be recognition, rewards, financial incentives can be a lever to pull on that front. So I suppose that's what I'm interested in. And we see the fragmentation, not just within the scientific community, but sideways across the system, right through to government, regulation, finance, not just the brilliant scientists that we see working all around the world.
And you mentioned your accident before that caused the paralysis. And I wanted to ask about, you know, the kind of headspace you were in the immediate aftermath. How did you, you know, reconcile with this? How did you then put yourself in the mindset to overcome this? It must have been, you know, a huge shock and potentially seemed like a huge challenge to get through. How did you overcome this and really put your mindset into trying to conquer this?
Yeah, well, the good thing is I can answer you not with the revisionist personal history of 10 years going by. I actually wrote a blog in intensive care. It was about 2 weeks after the accident, so I was still pretty banged up with a fractured skull and bleeds in my brain and massive internal injuries and broken ribs and, of course, the spine broken in two places. All of that added to the blindness that had happened 12 years before. And the blog that I wrote was titled Optimist, Realist or Something Else? ? At the end of it. So how should I respond to adding paralysis to the blindness? And I first of all questioned whether the decision themes that I'd been speaking about to companies for the previous 10 years, the things that I'd learned after blindness and by studying the teams that I used to race with as well as myself, whether those topics and those decisions were simply a way of me making a living by speaking to businesses, or how was I actually going to deal with this? And I started to recall and write about Admiral Stockdale, who was a prisoner of war at the height of the Vietnam War, and he managed to survive 8 years of incarceration and torture, not knowing if or when he might get out. But he said that the optimists were the ones who didn't make it. I think the reason the optimists didn't make it was because they just relied on hope alone, like they would get out at Christmas and Christmas would come and go and they still wouldn't be out. And they became disappointed and demoralized. And I, rather than being a pessimist or a catastrophist or a fatalist, being an optimist was an option, the others weren't, and I ruled out being an optimist, because if you rely on hope alone, you become disappointed and demoralized if the best case scenario doesn't play out. So the only one left really was to be a realist, and that means that we confront the brutal facts just as facts. As the starting point, we accept that we have options and that we chart a path towards a better future using hope. So the realists for me are about facts, acceptance and hope, and that's what I've been kind of working on, that challenge cycle, that response cycle, ever since my early days in intensive care. But it's been bumpy along the way, and it remains so. So I've even more cause to lean on that cycle.
That's really interesting to hear you say the thing about optimism and hope. I guess it's kind of depressing as well, you know. Don't be an optimist, you know. Being a realist will get you through things and kind of manages your expectations of things. And I guess that's the thing that can really help you pull through.
And look, it's important, as I think, you know, just looking at Stockdale, and even going back now, the people who influenced Stockdale were the Stoic philosophers from 2,500 years ago. But optimists rely on hope alone. Realists rely on hope alone. But the missing piece is that they also confront the facts as a start point, and they actively make decisions to move forward. So I'm not saying that the realists, it's not to resign ourselves that the status quo must be where we stay. It's not to accept that the starting point is also the finish line. The realists are also, and can be, wildly hopeful and ambitious. It's just the optimists miss the first two points, I think, the facts and the acceptance that they can influence the situation.
Okay. Yeah, that's encouraging to hear that.
I need to come up with a better way of explaining it, because people often accuse me of being an optimist, you know, with my stated aim to cure paralysis in our lifetime, but I think I would already be disappointed and demoralized if I was an optimist. So I approach it like a realist.
And is that your current attitude or outlook on life now, is the kind of, you know, have hope there, but also figure out how you're going to deal with the situation?
Yeah, like I think, you know, that sits very firmly in my research into the adapt orientation, or how we respond to challenges that inevitably appear, running that cycle on a daily basis, or for the big stuff over a year, 2 year, 2 years, 10 years. So, but the other things that I'm interested in are, as I was discussing earlier, why are we so poor at collaboration? And more importantly, how can we fix it? How can we create the conditions for trust to bring people together? So collaboration is another important thing, because adapting in a way is very, you're reflecting on yourself. It's sort of an individual pursuit. It's inside your head. And balanced with that, we need support of other people. We need to work with other people. We need to give a little. We need to gain a little. We need to have room for everyone in there. And then just sitting over, above, beside, in the middle of all of that is a performance lens. And that brings me to peak performance. Historically, it's philosophers and theologians would have described peak performances of human beings as mystical experiences, because we couldn't explain them. And then the psychologists started calling them peak experiences. And then more recently, we now, and the thing I'm interested in is the flow state, when we perform at our best and we feel our best, and the neuroscience of why that's the case. So I'm interested in all three of these areas and where they overlap: adapt, perform, and collaborate.
And you mentioned before your trip to the your trip, but you know,
yeah,
kind of journey, fun little trip to the South Pole. Do you have any more plans to go on any types of adventures?
Well, so I did about 3 years after my accident, the guy who organised the South Pole race, a guy called Tony Martin, who's an ex-British Royal Marine, he's a great guy, he came in to visit me in hospital. You know, I was still wiped out. I could hardly speak. And he said, right, we're going to get you up to Siberia to do a race. And we were working towards that, the Siberian Black Ice race. And I got a three-wheeler trike from Alaska, and I got some of the guys I used to race with, and we were going to go off and do it. And about a month before the entry went in, we were in Norway training, and the race got cancelled. It was a kind of point-to-point camping, moving camping, not unlike the South Pole, but shorter. And I must say, I was delighted that it was cancelled, because the experience in Norway was my legs. I had no temperature control on my legs, and I was really worried I was going to get pressure sores or frostbite that I couldn't feel, and I couldn't compete either. It had lost that attraction. So when I got back, I started really focusing on the efforts to cure paralysis. And for fun then, running alongside that, I got a tandem. And the tandem has a hand bike on the back. I'm sort of in a recumbent position. And then my South Pole teammate, Simon O'Donnell, he's on the front in a recumbent seated position using his legs. So we've got this tandem bike. We're now working on getting that down from 45 kilos, which is about, you know, 40 kilos heavier than a single bike. If we can get it down to maybe 10 kilos, that would be good. So we're working with an organization to see if we can do that. So I can't announce that, but that's very exciting, that particular project. And then the other thing we're doing is the bike's kind of a paralysis project, whereas the performance data that cyclists use, or really anyone would use, heart rate, speed on the bike, on the cycling, the revolutions per minute, the watts output, all of that data, plus environmental data about what type of a hill is coming up ahead of us, how long is that hill, that kind of environmental data. I'm working with another company, again, can't announce that, I'm working with another company to try and make that data accessible to blind people through voice, so I could say, hey, what's my heart rate, or else pre-staged announcements. So that's my current blind project, and they come together with the ability to do one-day, two-day, week-long cycling events. So that's my fitness hobby at the minute.
Sounds pretty cool.
But I'm not going somewhere cold. We're going to be doing that somewhere ideally warm, downhill, and
yeah,
flat. You know, flat downhills, slight drag downhill. I think that's what we need.
So at Yonder, our strap line is Tomorrow Without Constraints. And what would you say Tomorrow Without Constraints means to you?
Oh, that's interesting. Look, I think the biggest thing that holds us back is a lack of imagination. And I see, and have been fortunate enough to work with people with wild ambition and huge imagination for what could be in the future. And then it's a question of going back to this challenge cycle, starting with the facts, realizing we can do something about it, and then exploring the hope side of the equation and moving towards it. So perhaps removing the constraints of imagination might be the biggest thing with humanity.
I like that. I like that a lot. Is there anything else you're currently working on that you can tell us about? I know you mentioned a couple of things previously, but
I've got the bike project. That's my fun project. Then we have the speaking business, and we have online masterclasses and the speaking side of things. And this time next year, we will have Run in the Dark happening all around the world again. And then what I'm really passionate about is bringing together scientists, technologists, investors, and philanthropists to cure paralysis in our lifetime. So they're the four projects. But I think it is critical that we sort out a vaccine for COVID-19. And sitting here in Ireland with a pub, two pubs, less than 100 metres from me, it's critical that we can get back to rugby on the television for the 60s. Ireland doing better. I know that will be controversial for some of your listeners. Ireland did better, and then having drinks and analysing the match, win, lose or draw, with a pint of Guinness, even whether we are qualified to have an opinion or not.
Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
Where can people find you, for, you know, your website or social media handles?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that prompt. I'm always forgetting to do that. So my website is markpollock.com. My Instagram is Mark Pollock Explorer, and my Twitter is just Mark Pollock.
Great. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Yonder Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you can be notified whenever we release a new episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, please give us a 5-star rating.
Tomorrow, without constraints, ideas, people, technology, and limitless thinking, defining tomorrow without constraints.
The Yonder Podcast.